All right, everybody, let's get our guest on in the room. He goes by the name of Duvid. This is going to be an episode of Call Me Ignorant. You can follow him on Twitter at R-E-B Duvid, Reb Duvid, and that's Duvid with four O's, D-O-O-O-O-V-I-D. You can also go over to Duvid.com. He is a Hasidic Jew, a consciousness researcher. Pretty eclectic guy. It's kind of cool. I was checking out his content. He gets into science stuff. I mean, did a couple of these 6 or 7 hour streams. He does musical breakdowns, 3D printing. There's kind of not many things this guy isn't into if you go over to his website. Pretty interesting stuff, but we talk a lot on this program about the Jewish question and about things of that nature. But figured that I was kind of cheapening the whole deal by not having a conversation with a Jewish fella. So let's get him on in the room for a little chat. Hello, Duvid. Welcome on the show. Thanks for coming.
Hey, Shalom. Thanks for having me on. God
yeah,
bless.
Great. What does Shalom mean? Does that mean peace?
Yeah, it's usually translated as peace. I mean, it has multiple meanings, like completeness, or it could be a name of God. But you're generally just a greeting for like peace. Peace be upon you.
Okay. Great. So why don't you just tell, let's start with a little introduction. Why don't you just tell people a little bit about yourself? Like I said a second ago, you have your hand in a lot of different pies on the internet. You're into a lot of different things, but give us some background about yourself and tell us some things about you.
Okay. Yeah. Appreciate you bringing me on. I'm Duvid, David Kelton in Metro Detroit. Duvid's just the Yiddish name for David. I studied in Israel, Hasidic schools, kind of like rabbinic training, although I never officially served as a rabbi. I did some Jewish community relations for the Hasidic community in Brooklyn and New York City and a little bit in Metro Detroit. Mm-hmm. I promote Judaism. That's what I'm most well known for on the internet, is actually arguing with counter-Semites in the JQ. I'm a civil engineer by training. I do property management. I have a bookstore, eBay bookstore, also Duvid on eBay. And I have a wide array of interests. My biggest interest is consciousness, how the mind works, the heart problem of consciousness, and also a chess coach and a variety of things. I make all sorts of YouTube content, on my interest, trying to create like communities of people of similar interests. But like I'm by far the most views well known for, so to say, defending the Jews in JQ debates.
Yeah, I've seen you in some Twitter space, and I've seen you had conversations with Adam Green and other people of those types. And one thing, like I said in our private messages, this wasn't going to be really a debate or anything like that. When I have people on, I don't really. I try to throw my opinion or a little bit of pushback maybe two or three times when I have a question or a disagreement. But basically, I just want to get you on record on some definitions, things like explaining your worldview. So I have some questions, and they're very simple and to the point. So what is a Jew?
Just first, like I try to be honest and straightforward. Yep. So I separate like my view versus like mm-hmm. academic view or scholarship. Sure. And, like my view doesn't necessarily matter. My personal opinions, but someone who's studied and trained or lived experienced research to somewhat objective or within a Judeo context, a lot of times there's schools of thought, so you say, well, or even like percentages, that because there's a lot of disagreement on these terms. Jew is a European word, usually comes from the Greek translation of the land of Judah. Mm-hmm. So the Greeks created the term Jew to refer to the people that resided in the land of Judah. If you know your Bible, there was like the northern kingdoms and the kingdoms of David, which were referred to as the land of Judah. Mm-hmm. So terminology is what outsiders called the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. But the name is stuck in most Jews self-refer to as Jews. Generally, mm-hmm. in the Bible, it's disputed. Jews, you have the so-called Abrahamic faiths, and if you listen to Adam Green, he talks a lot about Esau and Jacob. So Abraham usually is not considered a Jew. Abraham is like the father of religions, and he has his two sons of Isaac and Ishmael. And Ishmael founds the Islamic nations, and Muhammad's a descendant of Ishmael. And then Isaac has two sons, Esau and Jacob, and Esau becomes the progenitor of Rome and Christianity, according to Kabbalistic understanding, and Jacob and his 12 son becomes the father of the Jewish people. So from mythological legend, the Jews are the descendants of Jacob that will eventually inherit the birthright, the promise of God to Abraham. So, you know, that's where you have the Judaism as a race, ethnicity, your family group. And then you have Judaism as a religion, where later in the Bible, God gives the Torah, the commandments to Moses, and the descendants of Jacob, the Jewish people, are bounded by the specific laws of Moses that eventually becomes formed into rabbinic law. And, you know, in modern days, because there's such a wide array of Judaism. Have you heard of Kevin MacDonald, the Cultural Critique?
I have. I'm not too familiar with his work, but yeah, go on.
He would probably do an interview with you. I mean, he's a evolutionary psychologist, and he wrote these famous books of Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy and the Cultural Critique, talking about why Jews promote liberalism, multiculturalism, and immigration in the West, or various things like the Frankfurt School and Freudianism. But to conceptualize that there's some sort of collective group strategy of the Jewish people, that Jews may be religious or secular, there's Israel and Zionism, but there's some sort of collective group strategy. And from that perspective, I usually acknowledge that there is a collective group strategy, and that there's other groups. If you're a blue-eyed man, maybe Europeans or other groups, you have a different collective group strategy, and there's conflict between group strategies. Such as the most famous issue, which maybe you talk about often, would be immigration and multiculturalism, where immigration and multiculturalism generally benefit Jews in the West, but may have a negative effect on ethnic European or blue-eyed people.
Good breakdown. So there's different schools, just to kind of mirror it back a little bit. There's different schools of thought of what a Jew is. I mean, you got all kinds of, there's all kinds of people that claim to be the real Jews or the lost tribe or whatever, but basically, before I do that, I'm not too familiar with this take that Esau became Rome and became Christianity. I've only heard that from, I just have cursory knowledge of that. So can you get into that? Is that a belief that Adam Green has? What is that whole, make sense of that whole thing for me?
Well, Adam Green is the biggest promoter of it. If you've seen some of his work, he talks about it the most. You're a Christian?
Yes, I am. And I'm not an Adam Green fan.
Okay, but do you know your Bible well?
Yes, I do.
So Abraham has promised to be a father to nations.
Correct.
And the understanding is that all of his children, not just the Jewish people, the descendants of Jacob, go on to found nations. And Ishmael, the Muslims and the Arab nations, and Esau, the northern nations. And the Bible brings down the descendants of both Ishmael and Esau. Esau, I think his grandson is named Edom, which you could refer to. Technically means the red one, and Esau was like the red one. Through Chronicles, the Bible brings down the descendants of both Esau and Ishmael, and then the prophecies in Daniel that talk about the end of days and the eschatology, that there's going to be a great war between, sometimes it's referred to the king of the north and the south, sometimes the east and the west, or Gog and Magog, that the war the world will basically be divided into three forces, basically, the east or west, north or south. Sometimes the verses say either one, and the Jewish people. And historically, you say that from the biblical interpretation, that's understood. I think even Daniel and some of the other prophets use the language itself, is that the east is represented by the descendants or spiritual descendants of Esau, in the West is represented by the spiritual descendants or possibly bloodline descendants of Esau. And obviously the Judaic biblical canon ends with Chronicles around the rebuilding of the second temple around 400 BC. Mm-hmm. So that's before Rome rises. So it was later the Talmud and the Kabbalist that interpret the biblical prophecies to say that, like, this Edom that is prophesied to become the dominant force in the West or the North is, in fact, Esau or Edom. And so some people will say it's, you know, literally like Romulus and Remus were descendants of Esau, or some just say it's a spiritual force, like to say like that Europeans are not necessarily bloodline descendants or the rulers, you know, conspiracy theories like the European royals or the Catholic Church, but it's just a spiritual force. So it's more a Kabbalistic rabbinic, but it's the mainstream Kabbalistic belief, and it goes straight with the mainstream biblical prophecies of like Ezekiel and Daniel, and just saying, well, the king of the north is Edom. And who's the most dominant force? Obviously it was Rome. So Rome was prophesied. You know, if you look, I mean, probably even as Christians, when you interpret like either the book of Revelations that is partially based on the prophecies of Daniel's and like the four kingdoms, that's obviously Rome. And then after that, we'll say Rome fell out of power, but the descendants of Rome became the Catholic Church or your Europe, the crown of England, or possibly America.
Well, yeah. I mean, that you seem to know your stuff, and I haven't looked into that too much, but I'm following what you're saying. And I always thought it was very interesting in Genesis where they're going through the line of Isaac and Jacob, and right in the middle there, it kind of gives you some of the descendants of Edom. I think they're called chiefs in the book of Genesis, and then it just goes right back to the line of Israel.
Consistent throughout the whole Bible, in that you always have these like lineages of Esau and Ishmael, because they're going to be important for the eschatology and the eventual Gog and Magog, or the world being divided into these two forces that are either going to be aligned under Ishmael or Esau.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So like you said, you're into a lot of different things, but you said you've become, one of the, defenders of the Jewish people, or countering people that talk about the JQ. But what do you think, why do you
I try to be honest too. So
yeah,
most like Hasbara, the Israeli kind of like propaganda, or a lot of defenders will, just like, reject anything that you say is wrong.
Yeah.
So I will try to, you'll say, well, if you're right, you're right. Or this is what the books say. This is what the Bible says. Take it or leave it.
Yeah.
So, okay, you consider yourself a Christian.
Yeah.
And I say, well, the Kabbalists consider you under the force of Esau. Mm-hmm. Like, take it or leave it. That's not what I say. That's what the sages say.
Okay. Yeah. What
is Adam Green is using that to attack Christianity in that sense. We're not necessarily attacking Christianity or belief set. I'm just explaining what I was taught, or what, so to say, the Hebrew sages said.
Yeah. So do you disagree with them? And what's your take on what do you think about this subject of the Esau, Edom, Rome thing versus what the scholars say?
You mentioned I'm a consciousness researcher, and I did years of prayer, Jewish meditation. I prayed for hours every day, chanted, and I've also done Hinduism and interfaith. From early on in my experience in Israel, I learned my opinion doesn't matter, and I don't waste my time forming one. So, like, I might have thoughts that enter my head that my thoughts say this is right or wrong, and I could use logical analysis, or someone could give an argument. But generally, like, I've came to recognize my opinion doesn't matter. So I just say, well, this is what the sages say. Mm-hmm. They're the sages for a reason. I could see why, even initially when I heard it, I was like, that can't be true. Or from a logical perspective, or just people who are agnostic or atheist think that it's ridiculous. Like as a wise man, I've determined that my opinion doesn't really matter, other than the use of the faculties of rationality or experience to examine the facts.
Yeah. Okay. Where do you I saw a little snippet of one of your live streams the other day that you were talking about how, I don't know if you use the term utilitarianism or pragmatism. If you have the pragmatic utilitarian approach, that you essentially have no morality in the first place. I don't know if I'm you know, bastardizing your words or whatever, but where do you derive your, you know, I'm a Protestant Bible believing Christian, and I believe in sola scriptura. I derive my ultimate authority from the Bible, from the scripture. Where do you derive your moral system, your moral authority from?
Well, I've created what I call the multiple truth hypothesis. And when you're listening to the beginning of my stream, I was talking about the history of philosophy and, you know, what's called the Vienna Circle and maybe a philosopher, Richard Rorty. And pragmatism is generally considered the philosophy of America, where we do what works, as opposed to the continentalists, the German philosophers that had more, you know, like a metaphysical, this is reality. These are the, you know, beyond, beneath the surface rules, as opposed to saying, well, we may never be able to figure out the rules, so let's just do what works. So that on my stream, I was specifically talking about the pragmatic view towards the history of science. But I've developed what I've called the multiple truth hypothesis, where there's different worldviews and systems that have conflicting ways to understand the world. So generally, I'm a believing Jew. I follow the Bible, the sages, but I'm also a universal humanist, you know, rationalist, a scientist. So any given issue, I will do my best to understand the various ways to understand it and then make a decision. So if it's practical, like I use the Hindu terminology, the Ahimsa principle, which is the precursor of the libertarian non-harm principle or utilitarianism, just like try to the least amount of pain or harm possible. So if there's a issue of conflict, I try to avoid conflict. And if conflict is necessary, to choose the path that limits harm. But I think, you know, relatively, like even you as a Protestant, you mean it'd be impossible to say I always follow the dictates of these rules, because clearly there's going to be cases where the rules are going to tell you to do something that might conflict with other rule-based systems like U.S. law or utilitarianism or pragmatism, that you might weigh against it. Well, in somehow rationalize it to say, well, the sages say this, my religion says this, but there's all these extenuating circumstances and reason that I might do something else. So just to be, you know, that's the practical aspect of you just to say I followed my religion on every single issue it's not actually you know how humans work. And then to be practical about how the mind actually works and how we actually operate, and then to say, well, what if there is a conflict between your belief system and one of these other things that you might respect, like a philosophical, moral, legal system?
Yeah, good point. I guess the Bible believing, it's an ultimate authority, and of course sin is in my life, and I do, you can't think about all things at all. Earlier you asked if I know my Bible, and I just said yeah, and maybe that was a, you know, because no one knows the Bible well enough, but I do, I'm fascinated by the history of the early Genesis history and stuff like that. So it's weird that I said yeah when, I mean, if you don't know all the rules, it's hard to follow them, that whole thing. But I'm a sinful man, so that, but I like what you're saying about we're in multiple systems. There's politeness itself is kind of a system, and you have to juggle all these different responsibilities or duties, and sometimes they come into conflict. I want to get back a little bit to the history of the Jews. How do the Jews know they're the Jews? You know, there's this one guy that I've just watched. I think my mom likes him. And he has this channel called Behold Israel. I don't know if you've heard of it before, but he says he's from the tribe of Judah. So what I'm wondering is, how does one know the tribe that they're a part of? And maybe you can get into a little bit of the so-called lost tribes. I know the Northern Kingdom was basically, I don't know what the word for it, but they were basically invaded and culturally mixed. But why don't you get into, like, how does a Jew know they're a Jew by blood, and the history of the 12 tribes?
Well, from the rational empirical perspective, you can't. If you're looking at the religion, like, you know, so say religion has different aspects, as you know, one, like a group strategy for social group cohesion, you know, like if you're married, have children, your school, your family, how you cohere and get along with your group, versus the mythology, the cosmology, the eschatology, how we came to be, what's going to happen in the future, and, you know, theological claims about the origin of the soul, what happens after we die, like karma, reward, and punishment, the nature of sin, punishment, reward. And so if you separate in that, well, philosophically, you're making a truth claim. So it's my religion, it's what I believe, or it's how we structure society, versus the actual truth claim. Is it actually, from like a scientific, historical point, true? And so, you know, philosophically, you can't, I don't know, 100% or the right word, you can't completely validate any of these truth claims. That's why it's a religion. Mm. So even most Israelis, you know, Israel's largely a secular state, and you have a lot of universities and archaeologists think that the biblical stories are mythical, that, you know, that there was no Jacob, or even the origins of the Jewish people, and, you know, might be evidence of the Jewish people first appearing, you know, far after, whether even there was a King Solomon, or these various issues, to say, you know, from like a scientific archaeological question, most people would reject that truth claim. However, you start having archaeological evidence, you know, Greece, Rome, somewhat before that, but, you know, the writing system, you know, the question was, did the Romans destroy Jerusalem? Were the Jewish people expelled? And the written record? So you're just putting that there to say, well, you can't validate that claim. So that's why you have all these various people saying, like, well, maybe the Khazars, or, you know, maybe it's made up, or because there's a claim like, well, I'm God's chosen people. So saying, I'm the real Jew, I'm the real Israelite. And really, yeah, what you're saying, like, I'm God's real chosen person. So as someone who studied Judaism my whole life, you know, over 25 years now, seriously, many hours a day, I know the large history of Judaism, the claims, each generation, you know, so there was 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, 10 generations from Abraham to Moses, 10 generations from Moses to King David, at least in legend, and, you know, from King David through the kings to the advent of the Second Temple, the sages, the rabbis, to modern times. And there is at least a claim that a lot of it is corroborated by archaeology, grave sites, a direct, you know, saying my family, how we got, I mean, some intermarriage, but, and I'm only half Jew. My mother married a non-Jew, but my mom's 99.7% Ashkenazic Jewish, according to DNA. And she has a family tree going back, you know, lived in Germany and Eastern Europe, that, you could trace the travels of the Jewish people through history and have a reasonable storyline of how the Jewish people, like your local Orthodox Jew or Jewish community, are factually the descendants of Jacob. Hmm. And so you'd have to go into large details of history. Yeah. And, you know, even this question, like, why is there so many Ashkenazic Jews, when I, you know, like, the Jewish population explodes in Eastern Europe, where there was like less than 1 million Jews in the world. But then in Eastern Europe, the population of just Jews in Eastern Europe balloons to like 20 million before World War II. And you say, well, are all those Eastern European Jews descended from Jacob? And so you say, well, to some extent, there's mixed biology. But if you're a believer from the religious aspect, or in terms of eschatology, like, you believe the prophecies of the Bible and what it says, that God promised the descendants of the Jewish people, that you know, makes a difference whether these people are actually descended from the, you know, the prophets of the Bible in terms of biblical prophecy. And then if you're looking like from, you know, the Kevin McDonald evolutionary psychology level, it doesn't matter, you know, the origin of the Jewish people, whether the Jewish people originate in Europe 1,000 years ago, or they originate 2,500 years ago in Israel or whatever, that somehow it became a coherent ethnic group that is genetically different and clearly has these characteristics and group strategy that causes us to act in a collective way that's decipherable. So, you know, you could see your local Jew, and whether you reject the history of it, you say, well, this person's what I call a Jew, and they clearly have a distinct ethnicity and culture and group strategy.
So, okay, so I understand that. What I'm wondering is if there's so many schools of thought, and they kind of, then they do disagree, and it's almost, from, correct me if I'm wrong, it's almost impossible to tell if someone is a real Jew. Why do people say they're Jew, they are a Jew then?
Well, because Jew has multiple levels of meaning. This, like, okay, what they call pilpul is like the ABCs of pilpul, where every question doesn't have an answer but more questions.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. What is that word, pilpul?
Pilpul, which literally means pepper, but okay, it was like in Eastern Europe, a form of like Talmudic scholarship.
Okay.
Of like, you know, like answering questions with questions, and like deconstructionism, yeah, where you say, well, your question doesn't have an answer. It actually causes another question, and that has, you know, a branch of multiple answers. And then from there on, you have to keep track in your mind of the various possible answer, like according to this school or according to this school. So you got like a basic form of intellectual rigor that you're just necessary, because you know, most questions don't actually have straightforward answers. They lead to more questions, and then you have to keep in your track of your mind multiple things. So, you know, like if you're familiar with Jean-Francis Grepi, mm-hmm, the public,
yeah,
space.
I've had him on before, yeah.
Okay, I debated him, I think, 5 different times years ago.
Okay.
And in fact, he was one of the first major broadcasts I got on. You know, if he's looking at it from evolutionary, like he doesn't, or Adam Green, they're rejecting the religious claim. So if you're looking at it from the Bible and you're like, well, there's these Jews, and it's important to know who a Jew is because you think the world operates through biblical prophecies. But if you completely reject that, or even if you think the Jews are descended from Khazars or some modern ethnic divergence that happened in Europe, there's still, it's meaningful that there's this group, because there's, you know, even if you're not looking at group conflict, or you like the Jewish people, you'll say the golden rule. I just want to treat people the way they want to be treated. And Jews have a unique characteristics to them. In order to follow the golden rule and to treat people the way they want to be treated, you need to understand how to treat Jews the way they want to be treated, and therefore you have to understand them. So, you know, I think there's multiple layers of that. So like, you as a Christian, are you concerned about the biblical prophecy? Or are you just concerned about sociology? Or you as like maybe a white man or a nationalist, you're concerned about the changes happening to society and the culture wars, and you might be looking at immigration, multiculturalism, abortion, or these various issues, and you're fighting, and you get to the town square and you see that the people on the opposite side of you, there's a lot of Jews, and they become your political opponents.
Interesting. Yeah. And I, you know, I've listened to you on a couple Twitter spaces, not too much about, regarding the JQ, but I find you to be a very reasonable and very, good representative of what you would call the opposing side. So let's get into that a little bit. What is the JQ? Cause I mean, I'm pretty new to this game. I've only been talking about this stuff for a couple years, maybe 3. I'm definitely not as what you would call hardcore or militant, certainly not as angry as a lot of the people on my side that are, you know, counter-Semitic or whatever you may have. But what is the Jewish question as presented by my side? Because I sometimes don't even know.
Your side, you mean like blue-eyed people or?
Sure. I mean, just people that talk about Jews and don't want them running the world. The caricature of it. People that want a Christian nation. People that don't want Jews in power. And you know, anyone from Adam Green to me to Adolf Hitler to whoever. You know. So yeah, what's the Jewish question?
Okay. Well, the first real articulation of it is in the Bible at the beginning of Exodus, where you know, Joseph dies and a new pharaoh rises that doesn't remember Joseph, and he sees that there's all these Jews, and he becomes scared lest the Jews team up with their enemies and turn against Egypt, which is the essential articulation where, you know, if you know the Bible story, Joseph, you know, comes down, he raises the power, he brings his brothers there, and then you know, later, a few hundred years later, there's all these Jews and they're powerful in Egypt, and the new Egyptian, you know, Pharaoh doesn't even remember Joseph or how these Jews got here, and he just sees there's all these Jews and they have power, and he's concerned about it. So that's, you know, the straightforward, like, biblical source of it, in the basic articulation. The Jewish question largely comes in Europe, in Germany. I think you have, like, the League of Anti-Semites, the name slipping me, the guy who created the term anti-Semitism, which is basically a question, like, who are these people who live amongst us that have different ways, that have different interests? And then at a certain point that you know, they have power. Like, so if you're in Europe or you're in America, and you know, you're just like, well, who's the leadership, who has power? And you're looking and say, well, a lot of them are Jews. So who are these people? What that's the Jewish question. And so if you, like Luke Ford, who I started streaming with, who's an Anglo Seventh Day Adventist convert to Orthodox Judaism in Hollywood, interesting character. You could consider having him on the show, but he phrased it, you know, the question is net positive or negative. Are the Jewish people a net positive or negative for society? So you might be looking, you know, saying, okay, you're looking at society, you see there's a lot of Jews in power, Jews have certain positions in a lot of the, you know, the culture wars, like not all Jews, but collectively, yeah. You know, like Kevin McDonald, Jews push for immigration, multiculturalism, maybe even things like abortion, leftist issues, or directing American foreign policy in wars in the Middle East or various things. And you're like, I'm against that. I don't think we should be doing it. It's not in my interest. And clearly the reason, one of the reasons why culture is moving in that way, because there's Jews who feel that that's in their best interest and they're pushing for America to act that way. But you might also have a whole bunch of things you like about the Jewish people. You know, like 10% of doctors are Jews, dentists, accountants, comedians, or you know, various things. You might have Jewish friends if you're in the music business, or you say, like, I like my Jewish friends. You know, like Dave Mustaine, I think, is a half Jew. You have a lot of good Jews.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of famous musicians, or you know, like, you know, the Kiss, Gene Simmons, or whatever reason. Sure. Like, I like, you know, like, there's things you like about the Jewish people, but you look at net positive or net negative.
Yep.
So if you lean, God forbid, towards net negative, then the Jewish question, you've answered the Jewish question, it becomes, God forbid, the Jewish problem. So you're saying Jews are a problem, that you think you're looking at society, God forbid, and you think the Jewish people are net negative, and it's a problem that has to be dealt with. Or if you're looking like, okay, you would like to be a Christian nationalist, you would like America to be a Christian country, obviously almost no Jew is going to agree with you on that. Almost all the Jews are going to collectively use all of our power to fight you on that. And so how vested are you in that fight, where you're going to look, well, my fight is, I mean, there might be other people like Muslims, Hindus, atheists that are also going to fight you on that, but you say, well, the Jews are standing in your way of getting what you want. So you know, that's the origin of the Jewish question, or, you know, God forbid, even worse, the Jewish problem. And there's all sorts of various things people focus on. You'd be like, okay, like, God forbid, Jews are disproportionately running pornography, or, you know, the cultural wars or deterioration of the West, or, you know, fighting Christianity, or promoting immigration, multicultural, any of these issues where you could say, I want society to move in this way. And there's one of the biggest reasons that you feel that society can't move in that direction is because organized Jewry is pushing in the other direction. So you know, it could be censorship, any sort of these issues. Hmm. And then you could argue. So if you're pro-Jewish, you could argue any of those issues, like, wrong. You're like, Jews aren't, you're like, you're like, you'll push back on every single
one. Yeah, every single detail, 100%. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, okay, yeah, so it's a spectrum.
I'm generally more like, it's like, yeah, but. So like, yeah, like,
yeah.
There is a group conflict. You're the, yeah, like, obviously, so that's why I'm maybe more popular among the defenders of the Jewish people, or although I get a lot of pushback from fellow Jews, like, you should have argued every single one of these points, because I would acknowledge that, say, like, yeah, like, a lot of these Jewish questions, you could see, like, yeah, clearly you have an interest as part of, you know, an individual in a group, and collectively the majority of the Jews are on the opposite side of this issue from you and are directly pushing to pull society in the different direction than you want to pull society.
Gotcha. So it, for a second of what you just said, it seemed like you went and I just want to just correct me if I'm wrong for a second in that, in what you just said, you did include your own beliefs in there where you are opposed to things like foreign wars and open borders. Was I right about that, or were you just presenting another side of the argument?
Well, so personally,
yeah,
I lean libertarian, take things issue by issue.
Okay.
So as opposed to the majority of Jewish people, I would oppose U.S. involvement in these foreign wars. Although, you know, generally I'm pro-immigration and multiculturalism.
Okay.
And I would oppose Christian nationalism. So if you're just arguing, like, you know, just as a friendly conversation or scholarly to say my opinion doesn't matter, here's the breakdown of organizational Jewry and the polling and the demographics of how many Jews are on the sides of these various issues, where me as an individual doesn't matter. And then there's certain, you know, like I have my opinions on various issues that, you know, a lot of times is in correspondence with mainstream Jewry and is sometimes in opposition. So the one thing I tend to agree with, you know, like politically I lean libertarian.
Okay. Gotcha. So, you know, the reason I'm bringing that up is because that is an instance where you said earlier that you try to distance your opinions from the whole matter. That is an instance of you lean a certain way and you've drawn this conclusion from your from the information presented to you. And so you made a claim about you lean pretty libertarian on foreign involvement in wars, but you are in favor of immigration. And
I'm libertarian on basically all political issues. Okay.
How did you come to that? How did you come to that worldview?
In high school, it was probably my older brother probably introduced it to me. When I turned 18, I registered libertarian. I voted straight libertarian, and then I never voted again. But it was probably just a natural inclination of like I don't like to be told what to do. So like live and let live, you know, let people do what they want. You know, my heart pulls me, you know, maybe towards immigration, multiculturalism. Like I grew up in Metro Detroit, you know, whites were always a minority my whole life.
So
I've never lived in a white majority circumstance. I lived in New York. Like I've seen the values. I personally like multiculturalism. Yeah, I feel sympathy for refugees and immigrants. I'm not like an activist on those issues. So I say, like, you know, because America, like, you vote or we talk about politics. So I was like, in general, like, my opinion doesn't matter on those issues any. Like, what do you think about immigration? What do you think about, you know, like abortion? What do you think about all these issues? So, you know, generally, if I had to give an opinion, I would give the libertarian. But if you're asking my scholarship and to say, well, how did Jews organize? What did Jews feel about that? I could differentiate between how I personally feel and, you know, recognizing that, you know, like not many Jews are libertarian. There's probably less than like 2% of the Jewish people are libertarian.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know if you knew this, but I grew up in the Metro Detroit area as well. I grew up in Oakland County. I don't know if you're.
Well, I'm in Southfield right now.
Southfield. Oh, snap.
And I went to the Roper School, if you're familiar.
I went to Roper Camp, man. Yeah, that's where I went to summer camp when I was a kid.
God forbid if, you know, because one of the biggest complaints, like the JQ, is the Frankfurt School and Freudian. So Roper was a direct implementation of the Frankfurt School in Freudian method.
What?
Anna Marie Roper was a disciple of Anna Freud, Freud's daughter, and like another teacher, but it was designed somewhat like to implement the ideas of the Frankfurt School here in America. So like if you had that, like you went to the summer camp or whatever a few years, maybe you didn't know it when you were young, but you had a little bit of the Frankfurt School Freudian indoctrination.
That is hilarious. I had no idea, man. All I did was play with toy dinosaurs and, you know, stuff in the sandbox and things like that. I don't remember what I learned.
Maybe you called your teachers or counselors by the first name.
We did.
There wasn't like authority structure, or like as a kid you were talked to kind of like as an adult, and you were probably pushed with God forbid, like it's a directive of the Roper School was like to create leaders to prevent another Holocaust. Like it was straight there in the philosophy. The school was directly created to like, generally they wanted people with high IQ, school for the gifted, and to train leaders who would fight fascism, and you it was probably multiculturalism, and you were indoctrinated with the understanding America, the nation of immigrants, and multiculturalism as a good thing.
Yeah. Wow, that is hilarious. That's full circle right there.
I also went to the Orthodox school in Oak Park.
Yeah.
I'm active. I'm right here in Metro Detroit. Went to the Pistons, the Palace. We grab a coffee. You could check out my bookstore next time you're in the area.
Wow. What's the name of your bookstore?
Well, it's Duvid on eBay, but I mean, it's all in my house. If you say.
It's there. Okay. I understand. Yeah. Wow.
Come to my house or we could grab a bite, but
oh my gosh, I would love to do CDs. That.
Yeah. If you're a musician, I also sell CDs, LPs, DVDs.
Wow. Amazing, man. What is a couple more definitions there. What is Kabbalistic or Kabbalah? What is that?
So Kabbalah literally means like to receive. So the reason it's called Kabbalah is because the claim is it's the secret esoteric wisdom that was known to the prophets, but was not directly revealed and written down. So that's why it's called Kabbalah. It comes in legend. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was around the times the Romans conquered Israel, 1900 years ago, and revealed these secret esoteric wisdoms. But the Kabbalah is it's metaphysical about how God operates. So the Bible doesn't really, it just said like, here's the law, you got to keep it. In like the God's eye perspective, how God creates the world, how God runs the world, isn't really explained. Like this is just how it is, obey or be punished. Mm. So Kabbalah comes to try to explain metaphysical, like the connection between the spiritual, the material realm, also messianic stuff, like how what we're doing is leading to messianic times, some things like the nature of sin and punishment, reward, various things, also things about group strategy and the nations, the conception of the purpose of the diaspora, the expulsion of the Jewish people all around the world to eventually be brought back to Israel, and how that relates to the redemption. So if you know much like metaphysics or dualism, spirituality, and it's also like a deeper explanation of the rituals. It's like Judaism is largely a legalistic, ritualistic religion. So like, that's why I always, you're talking like Albert or Adam Green. It's like, well, yeah, you have the prophecy, you have these visions of what the prophets say is going to happen at the end of days, but that's not really important to day-to-day Judaism. Judaism is just like a law set that a person has to keep. So it tries to mystically tie the two together. What's the connection between the daily rituals and the law and the unfolding of events in the world? And it also has deeper spiritual concepts. Like it has a whole system of reincarnation and transmigration of souls. It reinterprets the Bible from a reincarnation point of view, where it'll tell you that various people in various generations were reincarnated. It has this concept of Tikkun, Tikkun Olam, the perfecting of the world. So the perfecting of the world has multiple aspects, saying the purpose of the Jews being expelled to the four corners of the world and brought back in is to repair the world. That like Anna Marie Roper, God forbid, was brought to Metro Detroit to teach you, Stephen, about Tikkun Olam so that, you could prevent the next Holocaust, God forbid. Yeah. Yeah. And then, then we could be brought back to Israel. But also that it's a multi-lifetime thing. So the mission of a person, so you have your individual mission of you in this lifetime. But then it's also like your soul has a mission that is carried out over multiple generations, specifically from the fall of Adam, where like the soul split and you have like we each have a fragment of the soul of Adam, till eventually the redemption of the world, the messianic era. So there's a whole bunch of stuff in Kabbalah, including like if you, the JQ type people, would include like, Jews have this special third part of the soul that non-Jews don't have. And that's why Jews are special or God's special arrangement, you know, how Jews perform Tikkun Olam, or even the origin of Jewish group strategy. How is it that Jews cooperate in this group strategy from a Kabbalistic level? It's because Jews have a unique part of the soul. It also talks about non-Jews. So that would be like Esau. So like, I'm sorry, you know, Stephen, you're a blue-eyed man. And whether you know it or not, Esau is your guardian angel. So like, you might think you have free will, but your free will is limited because you're under the guidance of Esau and Edom. So like, whether you know it or not, collectively, you're acting together with like the West and Edom to fulfill the mission of Esau.
Wow. Okay. Do you think
Adam Green like exposing the Kabbalist? So if you're looking like you know, that would be, you know, Adam Green, who's done a lot of research into it, would like expose those things that the Kabbalists talk about.
It's funny how you know, growing up in Metro Detroit, there's Jews everywhere. I am on the side of the fence of I am a Christian nationalist or whatever. It's hard to find what term to use, but I am on that side of the fence. And
universal humanist?
What is that?
I mean, Roper's founded in humanism, and it's part of like the Frankfurt School, but it just philosophically, it just be that all humans of all races and all people have the same essential value and characteristics. So like, say like anti-racism, like, were you at Roper enough that anti-racism and universal humanism, so you might say, okay, like, you're a Christian.
That's when I was, but that's when I was like eight, you know, I don't remember. Okay. So my point about, okay, so I do believe, you said two things about universal humanism. I believe that all humans have inherent value because we're made in the image of likeness of God, but I don't believe that all humans have, I would want to know what you mean by characteristics, like that we all have the same characteristics. What do you mean by that?
The driving motivations and psychology is the same among all people. So say what motivates you, or how your mind works, is how all people's minds work, how all people's motivations. They're not like good or bad people. There's universal human motivations and characteristics that drive us all. There might be group characteristics that some groups might have a different proportion of these traits, but the fundamental essence of all people is the same.
I would lean towards no. But I do believe in the inherent value of all human, but I don't believe that. Do humans basically all have the same motivations? I would lean towards no, but I'm also not a serious intellectual like that, so I don't have to think about it a lot. I haven't pondered that too much, but so to tie that into my next question, do you think it's morally wrong for Christian whites to want their own country?
Well, so as a dualist, you know, if you haven't thought deeply about the philosophy, I would say like morals and ethics are a spiritual matter. So, and you're saying that God is your judge. God is the judge of those things, not man. So if you're looking at like a legal system, that certain things benefit one group more so than the other. But like, is it good or bad? You have to have a metaphysical, philosophical system to understand good or bad. And like, okay, so the first debate I did with Jean-Francis Greppi, I argued against evolution. And one of the arguments against evolution is that you can't derive good and bad from a materialistic system. If you're just putting it, is it bad for you to want what's in your personal or group's best interest? It's like, well, you know, okay, so you talked about, I use the Hindu term, the Sanskrit, the Ahimsa principle, if you're familiar with that, but it just means the non-harm principle. So, you know, if you're saying, well, I want what's in my personal best interest, regardless of the harm that it causes to other people, or if you're putting some faction that would say, well, you want Christian nationalism, irregardless of the harm that that would cause to minorities, or you're making some greater calculation that the greater good. Yeah, like if you're just disregarding the harm that you're causing other people, that would be, you know, like you call evil or bad. And so there's an absolute approach. So utilitarianism would say that if overall it causes more good for more people, it's okay. So he's like, okay, the majority of people are white and Christian, so we should have Christian nationalism. and okay, it might harm the minorities. They might have to leave or go somewhere else or live as second-class citizens or convert to Christianity. But overall, harm will be decreased because it's going to cause more benefit for the majority of people, despite the harm it causes other people. But then there's the absolute approach where it says, like, no, like, it doesn't matter that you cause benefit to a large amount of people. You harm this person, that's sinful. You will be punished for it. You can't make up for the fact that you harmed these minorities. You took away their right to live and get ahead in society, or even, you know, achieve positions of power, even if it benefited you and your group, which makes up the majority.
Okay. But how is it harming? One thing I do concede that, first of all, I don't believe in the, you know, break a few eggs, got to make an omelet thing. I don't think it's Christian to, you know, sin in order to bring out a good outcome. Like, sin is sin, and you should do the right thing regardless of outcome.
The ends doesn't justify the
means. Yeah, absolutely. So I don't. Yeah, exactly. So I don't subscribe to that. I don't think it's Christian to subscribe to that. But I also think that removing people from power or not giving them a choice is not necessarily harming them. I think that removing someone's choice in the matter, I don't think that's a sin. I think God has removed all kinds of choices from us, and God can't sin. And I don't think that it necessarily, if you remove someone from a position of power or say that certain people can't choose or can't vote, that's not harming them. Now, if you, there are things that you can do if you give them, they, if you
but
take
it's not
their,
harming them much. I mean, say, well, it's harming them. You say it's not harming them at all, or it's not harming them that much.
Well, I don't think it harms them at all. I mean, if it's about you don't give them the choice, you don't let them choose food, that's one thing. But I'm just talking about the choice in how to run a society. That I don't think that causes harm at all. I don't think I was harmed by me not getting a say in something. I don't think it harms women to have them not vote, not have the right to vote. I don't think it harms them at all. How does it harm them?
Yes, I mean, a person doesn't have the right to power, mm-hmm. or if you're saying that you're talking about, I mean, because you're generally, like, I'm frowned upon by a lot of my fellow Jewish activists because I accept that there is a cultural war and it's zero sum. In the sense, like, you're like, America can't be Christian nationalist and multi, like, this is a battle and there only could be one winner.
Yes.
That if it becomes Christian nationalist, like, or it becomes multicultural, it can't really be both ways. So it's a battle that has to be played out that's going to have winners and losers. And so if you're going to try to argue, you know, like, a lot of Jewish activists was like, you know, like, no, Goy, it's in your best interest. You just don't know what's in your own best interest. So you just think this is in your best interest, but let me tell you what's really in your best interest. And yeah, as a libertarian, I think the U.S. system is extremely flawed in just the structure of the democratic process. And we have the spoil system. So, you know, one person, you win an election, and then that person who wins the election gets to basically pick, you know, the whole cabinet, all the people to run systems. And it's basically like that across the board in U.S. systems, that you rise to power and then you have the spoil system and you get to appoint all the people under you, you know, just from one election. And but you say the culture wars do have effects on people. And so if you're not talking like power, like, well, I have the right to rise to power, mm-hmm. versus to say I have the right to wage the culture wars, mm-hmm. Because you know, any of these issues, abortion is probably the most factional, the disputed issue in America. And to some extent, you know, there's got to be a winner and there's got to be a loser. So you say people have a right to push one way or the other, and it's going to have a winner and a loser. And so it's not necessarily I have the right to come to power and then force that upon you. You are, so to say, harming people to say, well, do people have a right to fight you on these issues? And how do you mediate or dispute who wins or loses? Like, okay, you lost, you know, suck it up and now live with being the loser the rest of your life, or do you come back to fight again and these things waxing and waning, and you're looking for like a moral, like you say, oh, I'm a good person, I don't want to harm anybody, But like, yeah, I am going to fight for these things. I do think that it's important. And then you're even going to claim, I mean, God forbid, like you take the extreme of the arguments with like Israel and Gaza right now, where you have the extreme of the like Israeli, we're not harming anybody. Like all those, like Hamas killed those people. They used human shield. Like they chose to attack us on October 7th. Like, the, you know, like the 25,000 people who died, mostly women and children, they did that to themselves, not me. So, I mean, you could take those arguments to an extreme. And that's what people fear. Like, well, Christian nationalism, eventually, you know, if you get your way, you're going to start doing, you're going to push out America or kill us. And he's like, no, we aren't. You're just going to, you know, so there's a certain, maybe you say irrational fear versus saying like, I don't want to live under Christian nationalism. Yeah. Even if you say I might relatively have all the amenities and qualities of my life under Christian nationalism as I have now.
Yeah. 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 That's where I think the fundamental or the sticking point of this segment of the interview is that, of course, I mean, murder, physical harm, withholding food, withholding water, those things are absolutely harm. I don't think anyone would argue with that, but I think of it, if you have a child and you withhold their choice to do something, you're not necessarily harming them. And I think that doesn't work, just work for children. That works for all people all time. They're not synonyms. Now there's overlap, of course. There are things that if you give someone not a choice, you will be harming them. But it's a non-zero amount of things that if I withhold the choice from someone to do something, I don't think it's even immoral for a nation to kick out people out of its country, regardless of group. I think that a nation does have agency, whether any nation. That's why I call myself a national. I barely even call. I'm an international nationalist. I think that nations have a right. You know,
the moral is ill-defined because you say like clearly you're causing harm to those people. So you say utilitarian, that if you're saying okay, it's causing greater good for a greater amount of people, even though these people were harmed. And then the limit of the harm, but like, I mean, clearly kicking people out of the nation is at least individually unjust to that person, causing them harm. Maybe they'll be able to go to greener pastures somewhere else. Maybe they won't. But you know, to use the term morality, I mean, from the Kabbalistic point of view, like there's double ledger accounting where you have your good and your bad. And there's dispute among spiritual systems to say, does your good cancel out your bad, or are they just two separate calculations? So like you moralistically, you'll say, okay, one day I'm going to die. I'm going to stand judgment for all of my sins. I'll be rewarded for all of my good. And there could be one understanding that I'm going to go to hell. I'm going to be punished for all of my sin. And then after I've finished my purgatory, I will receive the reward for my good. As someone else might say, okay, like I'm going to die. And, you know, maybe I have a lot of good and some bad, and the bad is going to be subtracted from my good, and I'm just going to be able to be rewarded for my good without being punished for my bad because it was subtracted from my good in like a double ledger accounting. So if you're looking at moral in terms like pain and say, well, no, I mean, maybe every sin we do, we're going to be punished for. And it doesn't matter if we've done 1,000 times more good than the bad. You did one sin, you're going to be punished for it. There will be purgatory. There will be punishment for sin, no matter how much good you do. So if you take from that school of thought, like, no, you harmed that person, even though Christian nationalism worked out for the vast majority of people, created a better society, but that person wasn't Christian and you forced them to go, you caused harm to that person. Right? I mean, you might be able to give some argument where okay, like, no, I mean, it was in their best interest to find greener pastures where there are people more like them. But if you're going to try to be metaphysically accurate in your thinking to say you can't legitimate harming other people, or at least you have to acknowledge that you're harming other people, and you say, well, relatively I'm still going to push forward through it, acknowledging I'm harming these people, but because of the greater good.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, great. I mean, so we're about at the end here, but I have a couple more questions. And the thing is, I want to get to something a little that's not on topic. I want to ask about you and your music at the end here, but I would be kicking myself if I didn't ask you about the tunnel thing in New York. You're a Hasidic Jew, you know, that whole, you know, Jews coming out of tunnels story from a week or two ago.
Yeah, and I've been to that synagogue like 50 times.
What's your thoughts on that, man?
I think it was somewhat a media circus. It's a little bit of a mess there. So, like, obviously people think that that rabbi was like Messiah. He passed away in 1994, and there's factionalism. But I think the tunnels was a misnomer because it was basically an illegal, and I'm a civil engineer. I used to do building permits also in New York City. But it was an illegal building expansion, and there were issues with multiple sides of how to do the expansion. And so a faction of the people started to just illegally start expanding the building from underneath. And so the tunnels were a method to do it. And so, you know, put it like in terms of the tunnels, it unnecessarily leads to conspiracy theories that aren't related because, you know, what it was just an illegal building expansion excavation.
And what do you think about the mattresses and stuff, like the stuff they're dragging out of there?
Well, I mean, God forbid, there were probably people living there in the temporary. So, like, why there were people living in the temporary expansion area? So, I mean, my understanding, like, one thing, you had international students that were, you know, just trying to study religion and were living in the synagogue and, you maybe didn't have any money and were, you're sleeping temporarily. And then they also had, you know, God forbid, migrant Mexican laborers that were doing most of the work. God forbid it was the Mexicans doing the labor. So the mattresses were for the laborers that were living there also. So, I mean, that the mattresses were there because people were living there.
Gotcha. All right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I took some notes on what you're talking about, and I have a ton of follow-up stuff, and I'd love to have you on again sometimes. And you seem like a clear thinker, and you're definitely rational, and you're not, I don't know. I think that both sides of every single dispute, whether it be the JQ or anything else, could do, would be doing good for the world to just be, to step across the aisle and be calm and rational about it. And it doesn't have to be this pissing match and that it is always on Twitter. That's one of the reasons I don't like Twitter spaces all that much. They can really devolve very quickly. But before we wrap things up, tell me about your music. You were commenting about music in the chat earlier. I see you got, I think that's a guitar or a ukulele behind you, but you make music and you do deconstruction videos. But tell us about your music career, if you want to call it that.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have any of my own music. I haven't had the inspiration to produce. Like, I do mostly chanting, religious, that have been probably like Hinduism or Hasidic Judaism. Chanting, singing, communal chanting is an extremely part of important part of Hasidic Judaism. And then, yeah, I was involved a little bit with the Hare Krishnas or different Hindus. I like chanting so much. I'll do like Indian bhajans. I also, in New York, did party promoting, music promotion. I had a few, you know, Jewish like rock bands, and we used to rent out, you know, even like we even rented out a few times CGBGs in New York. And I mean, it's a famous place, but relatively it's a minor club that only costs a few $100 to rent out because it doesn't, most of the time there's nothing there. But we even rented out CGBGs a few times and did shows, and I even had rappers. And then I also have my own interpretation of music, largely through Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey. And some of that, you know, you could take on a musical understanding of like harmony, dissonance, and resolution to, you understand the structure of music. But to look at any given song is like, the goal of a good song is to take you on a journey. Mm. And, you know, like with the theme, the introduction to start you at a point and then raise you up and then bring you back down. And especially if you're doing like communal chanting, so if you had like, you like a chorus or something, that you stretch people beyond their vocal ability, where the chorus is you know, like taking people on a journey, bringing people higher than they could go, because the chorus might be more difficult than your average person could sing. But collectively, like if you're leading a concert, people will try, people will fail, and you've taken them on that journey. I also give the example, like in the most classic example would be like Rocky, the Eye of the Tiger, where, you know, like, so to say, the hero's journey, most of the hero's journey is preparation, work, and practice. So if you look at like Rocky, the movie might take place over months, and but most of, like, time wise in the movie, what they don't show you is him practicing, and so him practicing is reduced to like the 3 minute Eye of the Tiger.
Yeah,
I mean, you know what I'm saying. So, yes, like in the movie, like, you know, if you're thinking like, well, the story of the movie doesn't, like, well, here's 3 months of him practicing. I mean, the movie just has like the Eye of the Tiger with a few minute collage of him practicing, and you understand that he spent months practicing, and then there's the final fight. But you have to put that in life, where music kind of gets your repetition of the person going, and a good song spiritually is meant to bring a person to a higher understanding. And I've also interpreted, God forbid, from classical, you know, music to the modern, you know, anti-hero. So most music today is the anti-hero, you know, from like the Beatles, older music. It was mostly within line with Christian values, like boy meets girl, falls in love, gets married, builds up a family. You know, even through the Beatles, most of their music was relatively family friendly in that sense, where but starting in the 70s or the 80s, you have degenerate music becomes the norm. And like, I grew up in the 90s with grunge, where most music becomes the anti-hero, although it still has the same musical structure of, like, you know, theme, dissonance, resolution. Although also, if you analyze it musically, where the music has changed, also where it doesn't have the classical dissonance, resolution, and often the chorus itself is disharmonic, you're representing. So, I mean, if you want to talk, I don't know if you do this every day for 3 hours.
About, yeah.
So we could talk again on that, or if you just want to talk on music, or even we could analyze a few songs and go through them and try to understand them, or if you have your own songs or music, I could try to listen to it. And you're just thinking, like, you know, I had a rapper who was minorly prominent. He never had it. He had a deal, but he never came out with any CDs. But you know, he performed on stage, and you say, you got to talk to the people. You got to take them on a journey. So there's one thing, like, you're just a musician, you're writing music. First, okay, now you're in front of the crowd, and now you're performing, and you're connecting to the crowd, and you, like, you understand, well, you got to take the audience on a journey. You got to take them from point A to point B, and your music is the vehicle that does that. And then you could try to, you know, I mentioned I like to watch Rick Beato, and but I don't think he's came on to this, you know, Joseph Campbell, to put in terms of the hero's journey, but you know, it's like the what makes this song great. But if you add on to that, how are you taking the person on the journey? Where are they starting, and where are you leading them? And then also, like, the sign of the times, where music is historical of the time, like the Beatles or you know, grunge in the 90s, rap. The reason why it's popular today, because it's saying something about the times that we live in. And, you know, so you got to speak to the people. How do you speak to the people, and what's the journey that they need to go on? So I haven't been inspired with any of my own music. I don't know if you've written your own music.
Yeah. Sure.
Feel inspired, or you understand naturally what I'm saying, like, you feel you take people on a journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've written a lot of songs, hundreds. Yeah, I haven't released all of it, but I've three albums that I've done, and I'm producing my first album for another band in the next couple of months. So I'm picking up what you're putting down, man. All right, well, that was
perform in front of a crowd.
Yeah, I do. Sure. I mean, I'm taking a break this year to work on the YouTube side of things a little bit more. But yeah, I've played thousands of shows.
This one last comment. Yeah. I used to say this when I was promoting, like, you have to quarterback the after party from stage. Like relatively, the after party,
you just perform.
And sometimes the person, like, who's going to be backstage? Who are you going to meet? And you don't even know, because you're just performing. And then, you know, you're back there, like, what, if it's, you know, girls you're interested, or business people, famous people, who's backstage? But he's saying, if you have the cognitive awareness, you get quarterback that from the stage.
Sure. Wow. I'm going to write that one down. That's cool. Plug your stuff. Tell us where to find you. I'll have the links down below in the show description. I would love to have you on for another chat. I thought it was a really good conversation. Tell us where to find you.
Yeah, I'm Reb Duvid on Twitter. Duvid on YouTube's my biggest venue. I have a Facebook page. I'm on Odyssey, Rumble, across the platforms. Duvid with four O's. It's the Yiddish of David, Duvid. And I do property management. I work from home. I got my online bookstore So if you're streaming regularly, you know, daily, we could talk regularly, or if you want to, you know, do a topic or something, or yeah, music analysis, you shoot me a message and tell me what songs you want me to listen to, and I'll try to analyze them.
All right. Sounds great. I'd love to do it again. We'll be in touch. Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Have a good one. Bye-bye. Duvid, good guest. Really got to see how his mind works. I like the guy, man. I like the guy. Yeah, I mean, I'll maybe do a breakdown of the interview tomorrow or something like that. I don't know. My mind is a little fried. He has a lot of good stuff to say. It does logically follow. Duvid, Reb Duvid on Twitter. Not saying I agree with all of it. I agree with some of it. But I can see where he gets to the conclusions of a lot of this different stuff. But it's, like I've said before, it's a lot of it's just about the premises. I don't accept a lot of the premises, but again, these interviews are not about me. It's not a debate, but thought it was a good chat. Seems like a decent fella, and we'll talk again. Call me ignorant. It'll be out in a couple days. Love you. Well, thank you so much for checking out the content today. I really hope that you enjoyed it. If you want to see more of this stuff, you can go over to my link tree and follow all of the different places where you can do my social media and the different places I stream. That's linktr.ee/ignoramusmedia. The top links are Rumble, Odyssey, and my two YouTube channels. I stream 10 a.m. Eastern every single weekday. Usually try to have one or two cool guests per week. But yeah, Ignoramus streams on YouTube, Ignoramus videos on YouTube for streams and videos, Odyssey and Rumble, and the main spot, like I said before, is the Rumble. So if you search Ignoramus over there on Rumble, rumble.com/user/Ignoramus. If anything ever happens as far as censorship, you can always find me on Rumble. But once again, the daily Ignoramus is 10 a.m. Eastern time every single weekday. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you around.